From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the middle to late 18th century in London, when the most famous person in the world was writing and receiving thousands of letters. At the time, the most famous person in the world was an American, Benjamin Franklin, and he loved corresponding with people around the globe. In fact, today, he would be a prolific poster on Facebook, Twitter, and more. That's what modern historians and historical investigators think about Franklin. Just imagine trying to map out a man's social network when he only had ink and old parchment paper. Well, Benjamin Franklin wrote and received between 15,000 and 20,000 letters that we know of, and there's probably a lot more out there, sometimes being discovered in American attics as people move and find something that is wedged between floorboards. It has literally happened like that. And the person leading this investigation into Benjamin Franklin's social network is Carolyn Winter. She's the director of the Stanford Humanities Center. She teaches early American history at Stanford, and she is someone who has been finding some fascination in mapping out the life and social network of Benjamin Franklin. Now, later this hour, we're going to talk to people here at the University of Rochester who are doing essentially the same thing with the Seward family in Auburn. They were wondering, how does an idea move from a household to the American streets into the halls of our government in the 18th and 19th centuries? And they're tracking it through the letters that were written at the time. How interesting. Well, tomorrow, Carolyn Winterer, leading the Benjamin Franklin Project, is coming to the new University of Rochester Humanities Center. She's going to be speaking on a number of things. And first, she's our guest on Connections. Carolyn Winterer, welcome to Connections. Thank you for making time for us.
Thank you for making time for me.
Well, as the director of the Stanford Humanities Center, here you are coming to Rochester and the new Humanities Center here. And you're talking about a very interesting subject. Was there an American Enlightenment? And I think for those who've thought about it, some might say, well, of course there was, or some might not fully understand the context of the question. Why is this subject so interesting and so thought-provoking for you?
Americans today often speak of the fact that Americans are enlightened, or they believe that Americans should be more enlightened. And we often hold our nation to a standard of progressive improvement on a variety of fronts, anything from recycling to human rights to gay rights to school reform. We all invoke the idea of becoming enlightened as the justification for those improvements. President Obama himself frequently invokes the idea of enlightenment as a national ideal for Americans and for the world to aspire to. So I wondered, what exactly does that mean to become more enlightened? And I discovered that, in fact, Americans began to speak of having a particular tradition in the nation of becoming enlightened around the middle of the 20th century. They called this the American Enlightenment, and they imagined that it was something that happened during the American Revolution, that the ideals of republican government, of kingless government by the people, these were things that were very enlightened, and that was a moment when the nation had achieved these wonderful ideals, and this was called the American Enlightenment. And what Americans do today is to say, oh, we need to be as wonderful and enlightened as people were in the late 18th century when they had their wonderful revolution.
Do we over-romanticize or oversimplify? We use terms like the founders. Well, the founders would have done it this way, what the founders would have wanted. And I'm curious, in the context of an American Enlightenment, do we oversimplify and do we become too sort of wistfully nostalgic in that way?
Yes. Well, that is exactly what I discovered, that in fact, there was no such thing as the American Enlightenment. The phrase the American Enlightenment as an era was in fact invented during the Cold War, as Americans began to look abroad and see totalitarianism seeming to take over everywhere. They said, how can we know that Americans will not become like the bad Soviets? And they said, it is because we have a tradition of noble American enlightenment that stems from our Republican Revolution. Therefore, we are inoculated against totalitarianism in the way that, you know, the polio vaccine would inoculate you against polio. In fact, the two concepts emerged roughly around the same time. So the idea that there was a noble moment in the American past in the late 18th century when Americans, the founders, knew what was right and what was good, and they said that was the American Enlightenment, that is a national myth. That never happened. In fact, what I discovered was that Americans in the 18th century used the term enlightened. They wanted to become enlightened, but they were never sure what it meant to become enlightened. It was a dream. It was a hope. And in fact, they were always very anxious that their revolution was, in fact, enlightened. They looked around afterward and they said, huh, we have created this republic, but is it any better than a monarchy? There are all kinds of things that are wrong with our republic. How do we know that our revolution in the name of enlightenment, in fact, achieved enlightenment? So what I like to think is that, in fact, if we invoke an American enlightenment, it isn't right to say that it was a national moment of nobility in the American past, but in fact, an American tradition of questioning what it is that we are doing. Are we doing the right thing? And how do we know?
And potentially, how do we change if we, in our own self-assessment, determine that we are making mistakes or missteps that we can change, that we don't have to look back at our history and say it was almost divinely and perfectly conceived, that it was conceived in self-doubt and self-examination, yes?
Yes, exactly. In fact, the idea of a noble American enlightenment lodged in the 18th century is very much like the fallacy of constitutional originalism, this idea that, you know, the founders knew exactly what they meant when they penned the Constitution, and that there are meanings that are inherent and unshakable and literally true within the Constitution. This is a reasoning fallacy, and it's the same thing with the American Enlightenment. You know, there was no such single unalterable meaning attached to this particular thing. So yes, exactly, the discovery that enlightenment is not a kind of a thing, a shining golden bauble, but in fact a process of questioning, is so liberating for us because we don't have to tie ourselves to something in the 18th century that never actually happened. We can continue to ask ourselves questions about how we might improve in the future.
In a desire to avoid this becoming anything resembling a political discussion, I still want to push back a little bit, or at least try to get in the heads of what some of our listeners might be saying, which is that, okay, the founders weren't perfect, and they knew it, and they knew what they were creating would might need to change and evolve over time. And that itself is an enlightenment, and they should be celebrated for that reason, even if they weren't overtly saying, this is the age of American enlightenment, and we're creating something that won't have to be altered, etc. That what they did was really special and perhaps almost unique in the political world, especially at the time. And that is itself an enlightenment, no?
Sure. I mean, that is definitely one way of looking at it, that they, of course, they were very proud of what they had achieved. They looked around the world in the 1780s and 1790s, and they said, by golly, we are the first kingless republic of the modern era, in an age where giant monarch-centered empires were the ruling order, and they had decided to do something else. And that was really extraordinary, and they knew it, but that did not mean that they were not anxious about it. In fact, they spent a couple days in 1796 in the U.S. House of Representatives asking themselves whether it was okay to announce to all the powers of Europe that the United States was the most enlightened nation in the world. And they had a terrific fight about this. Some people thought it was a great idea to announce this to all of Europe, and others said that this was a terrible idea, that it would make the Europeans angry because they thought that their monarchs were the most enlightened people in the world, and they had good evidence on the other side to show that that was true. So this is why I keep coming back to the idea that enlightenment is not so much about answers, but it is about questions. And if we really want to perpetuate what the founders were thinking about in the 18th century when they thought about enlightenment. It is that tradition of questioning rather than the tradition of being sure about our answers.
So in other words, not to distill too simply your forthcoming presentation here in Rochester, but it does sound to me like you think there shouldn't be dissonance between the idea that we can look back on what's been done, we can be critical, we can seek to change it, and yet we can be celebrating the accomplishments and achievements of the founders. Those things are not mutually exclusive.
Exactly. They are not mutually exclusive. And, you know, when they thought about enlightenment, it wasn't just about politics. They wanted to be enlightened about a million other things as well. They wanted to be enlightened about geology. They wanted to be enlightened about biology. They wanted to be enlightened about slavery. But what I discovered was that becoming enlightened about slavery did not necessarily mean to them that you should immediately emancipate your slaves. It meant that you should, in some cases, just treat your slaves better, because they were very, very fearful about the effect of a large-scale, simultaneous emancipation of all of the slaves. So that's why I say it's better to separate, in some ways, our own ideas of what it means to be enlightened from what the 18th century meant about enlightenment, because you would find very few people today who would describe enlightenment as the process of treating slaves better. We would find that idea offensive. But it is one of the things that people argued in the 18th century in the name of enlightenment. So it's important to be aware of what we are doing now in the name of enlightenment and what people were doing in the 18th century in the name of enlightenment. Sometimes there's overlap, but not always.
My guest is Carolyn Winterer, the director of the Stanford Humanities Center and a professor of early American history. She'll be in Rochester presenting her presentation. Is called Was There an American Enlightenment? And you're getting a taste of it now. That's tomorrow, 5 to 7, Wednesday, 5 to 7 p.m. in the Wells Brown Room of Rush Reese Library. It's part of the inaugural year lecture series with the University of Rochester's new Humanities Center. Now, because I've got Carolyn on the line, I'm going to indulge some of my own interesting questions that'll help move the rest of the hour, because later in the hour, we're going to welcome some other guests locally who have been working on, I think, some similar things, which is the fun and the fascination of going through old letters and sort of creating, mapping out social networks. And Carolyn has been doing that with the Benjamin Franklin Project, the principal investigator of the Benjamin Franklin Project. So first of all, can you kind of just describe for our listeners what the project is all about?
Absolutely, yeah. So Benjamin Franklin sent and received roughly 20,000 letters during the course of his long life that stretched from 1706 to 1790. And what we are trying to do here at Stanford is to somehow look through all of those letters and try to establish the coordinates of his correspondence network. And we've focused in on a certain 20-year period because we would be overwhelmed by 20,000 letters, and to see who he was writing to, who he was receiving letters from, what kinds of places he was writing letters to, just to get a sense for what somebody's social network might look like 250 years ago.
I do enjoy the fact that I saw in one of the video presentations on this, you did say that Ben Franklin would love Facebook and Twitter.
Oh, he would love Facebook and Twitter. He actually has a Facebook page, but I don't think it is he who is updating it, but he does have one. He loved writing letters. Franklin has this wonderful, bubbly personality. He loves people. He loves people of all ages. He loves every subject under the sun, from discovering the Gulf Current in the Atlantic Ocean to inventing bifocals to inventing secret languages with his correspondence. We have to remember that in the 18th century, letters were the only means of long-distance communication. There was no telegraph at this point, so if you wanted to say something to someone far away, you had to use a letter. And so letters at this time have all of the emotional punch and impact that our emails do today.
I'm always interested in how letters are preserved and how fortunate we are that so many have been preserved. And if I'm remembering correctly, I think George Washington, a lot of his correspondence was lost. Maybe I'm wrong about that. But I'm curious with Ben Franklin, for example, how do we know exactly how many letters we think that he sent and received. How well were they preserved? You know, kind of give us a sense for just the physical work of retrieving and analyzing that kind of thing.
Yeah, so this is a wonderful question because it reminds us of how much of the 18th century is lost. So when I say he has roughly 15,000 to 20,000 letters, I say those are the surviving letters. We actually have no idea how many of his letters were lost. He, of course, was the most famous American in the world by the end of his life, and so people began to have a motive to preserve his letters, whereas earlier in his life, we have almost nothing because he was a poor and unknown person, and much of that correspondence has been lost to us. So we do not know our unknowns in some ways for Ben Franklin. Every year, new Franklin letters come to light. So, people of Rochester, check your attics. You may find a Ben Franklin letter. If you do, please send it to Yale University, which is the repository for the letters of Benjamin Franklin. But we could only analyze the letters that we do have. And, you know, we may be facing a situation, as you were mentioning with George Washington, where Martha, after his death, burned most of the letters that she and her husband had exchanged. And this accounts in part for why we have the image of Washington as a rather wooden figure. It is because we have lost precisely those letters between himself and his wife that might have given us a more rounded emotional picture of George Washington. So with Franklin, we don't know if there may have been some group of letters that is going to shed entirely new life on Franklin.
When we talk about finding new letters, I say new letters, finding anew a letter that is more than 200 years old, though, I would think it has to be remarkably luckily preserved, but I don't know. I mean, would it have broken down by now? You say if it's sitting in someone's attic, is it still going to be legible?
Yeah, you know, 18th century paper is really, really sturdy. In fact, in many cases, 18th century books are much better preserved than 19th century books, and that has to do with the kind of paper that people were using at the time. But yeah, it is still very probable that one could find a letter from Ben Franklin. They're often in the strangest places, these 18th century letters. They might be tucked into a book. I've definitely had the experience of opening up a 19th century book in an archive and having a letter of a famous person pop out of it. Not a Franklin letter, unfortunately. But the other thing to remember is that they didn't have Xerox machines in the 18th century. So for big letter writers like Franklin and Jefferson, they often made two or three copies of their letters so that they could file one and then send the other one. So we know that for many Franklin letters, there are two or three copies of those letters at different repositories around the country. So when you do find a Franklin letter, it's not necessarily the unique version of that letter, which presents a whole other interesting facet of history to contemplate.
You have said that in some ways this feels like a whole new Franklin we're still discovering here. What are some of the biggest surprises? What are you encountering that maybe you didn't expect?
Yeah, well, so what we did was to map his social network between 1757 and 1775. Why did we pick that roughly 20-year period? Well, it was the first time that he had spent a considerable amount of time abroad. He spent those two decades in the imperial British capital of London. And this was the moment before the Paris decade. He was in Paris from 1776 to about 9 years later, negotiating for the American patriot cause. But it was during the London decades that he rose to become the most famous man in the world, not just famous through his famous electrical experiments, which he had done in the late 1740s, but famous as a person that people actually knew because they had either met him on the streets of London or they had received a letter from him. So what we discovered was that it was during these critical London decades when he sent and received approximately 3,500 surviving letters that he made the leap from being famous as a kind of distant figure to people to being known personally to people, and that's a really important distinction. And he made a lot of trips to the continent during those two decades. He went to Paris, he went to Germany, Scotland, Holland. He made essentially the leap from a correspondence network to a social network, which is a much richer, more emotional kind of association to have with people. So that was really the discovery there, is how someone goes about becoming the most famous person in the world. And I have, you know, some tips for people if they want to become the most famous person the way that Ben Franklin did. And one of the tips is that you really have to get out of your comfort zone, and you have to start writing to a lot of people who aren't like you, who have a different gender, who have a different nationality. You have to really take that leap in order to become personally known to people.
Some of the old letters that we'll find from famous names to us are more formal. Some are very chatty and sort of gossipy. What are some of the defining characteristics of the way Benjamin Franklin communicated?
You know, Ben Franklin was everything. He was everything that you said. You know, during the course of his life, he adopted roughly 40 pseudonyms in his published writing. You know, he's Poor Richard of Poor Richard's Almanac. He is Father Abraham. He likes to play with different personalities, and he does exactly the same thing in his letters. It really depends on what point in his life you are catching him. During the Paris years, he's just having a grand time getting to know a whole bunch of other people. So he's inquisitive, he's chatty, he's gossipy, he's just really charming. One of the things that happens during the Paris years, and I think your listeners are going to be able to relate to this, is that he gets so busy and so overwhelmed with correspondence that he can't keep up with it. And so those letters, he gets angry, short, and there's a lot of letters during that time that he doesn't even bother to answer. And we've all had that experience of receiving so many emails that after a while we just give up answering them. This was a phenomenon that was already known in the 18th century.
And you've also said, if I have this right, that some of your work has helped kind of challenge the cherished American idea that Franklin was a lone genius, yes?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Yeah, so like everybody else, Franklin existed in a world with other people. And this is not to deny in any way that Franklin was a brilliant man with so many interests, absolutely extraordinary mind. But he did not go through the world alone, and he relied on a social network of patrons and helpers to elevate him to certain positions in life. His letters on his electrical experiments, in fact, went to his patron in London, a man named Peter Collinson. And Collinson made sure that Franklin's experiments on electricity, which we have to remember were occurring on the furthest fringe of the British Empire, really the sticks. You know, Philadelphia was the sticks in the 18th century. But it was Collinson that brought those experiments to the attention of the Royal Society of London, which was the most esteemed scientific body in the world at that time. Without Peter Collinson, we wouldn't know about the electrical experiments, or at least we wouldn't know about them in the way that we do now. So he definitely was a brilliant man, but he was a man who functioned within a network of other people.
We have a few more minutes left with Carolyn Winterer, the director of the Stanford Humanities Center and a professor of early American history. She'll be in Rochester Wednesday. That'll be tomorrow, 5 to 7 p.m., in the Wells Brown Room of the Rush Reese Library. She is coming to present on the question, was there an American Enlightenment, as part of the inaugural year lecture series for the new Humanities Center here at the University of Rochester. But she's sharing a few minutes with us on some of her other work that I find so fascinating as the principal investigator of the Benjamin Franklin Project. And, you know, Carolyn, I should have looked this up. I know there have been studies that indicate that a certain population of Americans now think that Ben Franklin was a president, and as you say, is the most famous person in the world at one point. Some might wonder, what are we learning about his views of politics and political power from his letters?
Oh, well, that's a great question. You know, I think one of the reasons he didn't become president was because he was just too old. You know, he died in 1790, just basically at the moment when there was the first president. So, you know, if maybe he'd lived a few decades longer, he would have had his chance in the White House.
Would he have wanted it?
That's a good question. You know, the presidency is not for everybody. Some people, and Franklin may have been one of these people, function best in other realms of politics where, you know, the halls of the legislature or places where they can peddle their influence behind the scenes. You know, it may be that Franklin was most comfortable in those other venues, but we'll never know because he died in 1790. So,
and so, what do you need going forward? What are we going to see as sort of a conclusion for the Benjamin Franklin Project?
Well, we would love if we had the opportunity to map his entire social network, because we would love to know what happens during those Paris decades. The lion's share of Franklin's lifetime correspondence is from the last 15 years of his life, the time he spent in Paris and then the 5 years back in the United States after his return. We have not been able to analyze that part of his network because, you know, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. We haven't had time yet. But we would be really, really interested to know certain things, like when he goes to Paris to negotiate for the American cause, he is officially a traitor to the British Empire. Does he lose his wonderful London correspondence during that time? Does he start to block off the many, many friends and acquaintances that he made in London when he essentially joined the enemy ranks? We would love to know things like that. Or was he such a sociable guy that he kept those friendships? We really don't know. We do know that he made friends with a lot of French people during that time. That's the time when many, many, many people in France joined Franklin's social network. But we really don't have a sense yet for what happens when your social network is cut in half by war. And that would be a really interesting thing to know.
And will there be a kind of publication that will allow the public to consume the work that you've been doing on this?
Yeah, so we are hoping that this will appear in the flagship journal of all of the field of history, the American Historical Review, as part of a larger forum on early modern social networks. We're submitting it in December, so hopefully we'll see it next year, and I'll let you know when it's out, and we'll try to make it available to people.
For me, this is fascinating, not just for the interest. I mean, I have always been fascinated by correspondence, especially at a time that wasn't nearly as amenable to corresponding easily like we live in today. So I find that fascinating. But I also feel like as time goes by, rather quickly, we tend to move toward hagiography instead of looking at people as real human beings, whether it's JFK, Ronald Reagan. It's almost like their passing allows us to just massage over whatever is uncomfortable, or even some of just the rich layers of detail, and we kind of caricaturize. And so the longer we go, it seems, the more we do that. And I find great value in finding what a person was truly about, whether it is a social and a friendship network, their views on politics and art and more. How do you view it with Franklin, for example?
Yeah, well, I think that's a really astute observation. As I always say to my students, our goal as historians is not to judge the past, it is to understand the past. And what we are trying to do with Benjamin Franklin is really to lift him out of American national history, where he occupies a prominent place, which is wonderful, but to restore him to the history of the world. He was really a citizen of the world in the 18th century, the first American that we can really make that claim for. And it's so interesting to see how American history is not just about the United States. It's always been about the larger history of the world. So what we're really trying to do is to give Franklin back to the rest of the world. And we think that by mapping his social network and showing how international it is, we can begin to do that.
And let me tie the themes together with my final question. How would Benjamin Franklin have answered the question, was there an American Enlightenment?
He would have said exactly what I said. He would have said, Carolyn, you are absolutely right. He would have utterly approved. Yeah, you know, he was one of the people who said that what he was doing was enlightened, but he never said that there was an American enlightenment. So I think he would have had sympathy with what I'm trying to do.
We look forward to your visit in Rochester at our Humanity Center at the University of Rochester, and look forward to more of your work, not only on Benjamin Franklin, but so much more. Thank you for sharing some time with us today.
Thank you.
I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, we've got election results and a look at what happened and why with some local leaders. Then second hour, creating tomorrow's engaged citizens. Think students are sort of self-involved or cynical? We're going to meet some local teachers and students who are working to make sure students are engaged in their communities. That's Wednesday on Connections.
This is WXXI AM Rochester, WRUR FM and HD Rochester, WEOS FM and HD Geneva, and WXXI FM HD2 Rochester.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Veterans Outreach Center, located on South Avenue, serving the Rochester region since 1973. Programs support veteran reintegrations with housing assistance, substance abuse services, creative arts therapy, and more. Visit veteransoutreachcenter.org.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So you heard the story of how they've been mapping the social network of Benjamin Franklin. Now we've got a chance to look locally at what's happening at the University of Rochester with the Seward Family Digital Archive Project and the people involved with that. Serenity Sutherland is here. She is a PhD candidate in American history and the project manager of the Seward Family Digital Archive Project at the U of R. Nice to have you here, Serenity.
Thank you, Evan. We're glad to be here.
Blair Tinker is here. He is a GIS specialist at U of R River Campus Libraries. GIS stands for what, Blair?
Geographic Information Systems.
Very good. And also here is Camden Bird, also a PhD candidate in American history and the tech manager for that project. Camden, nice to have you.
Well, happy to be here.
Well, let me start with just the question on Seward, because, look, last year I had a chance to read this beautiful biography. The author was here, so it's still sort of fresh in my mind, but just reminding our listeners who Seward was. And Serenity, of course, he was Secretary of State, could have been president. In fact, a lot of people expected him to become president instead of Lincoln. What's the short biography on William Henry Seward?
Yeah, William Henry Seward is a local guy to upstate New York. He lived in Auburn, New York with his wife, Frances, and their family, and he became very involved in New York politics as a state senator. He also became governor of New York. He went on to become Secretary of State, as Evan mentioned, and he's perhaps unfortunately, but most famously known for Seward's Folly, which was the purchase of Alaska. But there's a lot more to William Henry Seward than his political career. And unfortunately, people, when they write about William Henry Seward, tend to focus on his political life. And what we're doing at the Seward Family Digital Archive is in the name, and we're focusing on his family, on his fascinating wife, Frances Seward. She was a major abolitionist, and she was actually often spurning William Henry Seward to be more of an abolitionist in his political
She was occasionally disappointed in him, wasn't she?
Oh, she
and the letter mm-hmm,
the letters scream with disappointment upon occasion, both political and with family issues, when he wasn't home for Christmases or when he missed so-and-so's birthdays. So they loved each other, they supported each other, but there was also some tension there.
I suspect our listeners know this, but again, it's worth pointing out as well that on the night that Lincoln was assassinated, that was an attempt to not only assassinate the president, but to decapitate the leadership of all of American government. So the idea was to assassinate Lincoln, the vice president, the Secretary of State, and William Henry Seward was attacked in his home and nearly killed. I think he needed jaw reconstruction, or I'm trying to remember exactly.
Yeah, he had been injured in a horse carriage accident, and his jaw had been dislocated, and so he was already injured and immobilized in bed. And when Lewis Powell, or Lewis Payne, depending on which source you're looking at, came into the room to assassinate him, William Henry Seward was completely laid flat. Now, one fact that people often leave out was his daughter Fanny was there, and she recorded all of the events, and she witnessed the whole thing, and she would record it later in her diary. But the attacker came in and stabbed William Henry Seward a number of times and injured his sons Gus and Fred as well.
And there were some knife wounds to the neck, if I remember.
Yeah, the stabs were in his upper torso and ranged from his neck to his chest and all over.
Remarkable that he survived that. And really a fascinating family. I really recommend Walter Starr's book that we featured on the program last year. It's an interesting read. And now you have this rich treasure here at the University of Rochester and the River Campus Libraries with this project. And what is the overall goal? Serenity, how do you describe it? It's been going on for years now. You got a long way to go here. What's the goal of this project?
Yeah, so our primary goal is to digitize all of the family letters of William Henry Seward and Frances Seward's family. Now, this includes letters from aunts and uncles, cousins, to their children, to grandparents. So we have a range of letters from the dates of 1812 going on up to 1872, so about a 60-year span. And we're going to digitize. We've almost digitized up until 1842, and we're going beyond, and transcribe all of those letters. And when we're transcribing, we annotate. So we have to find people, places. We're even finding books, works of literature from the 19th century. And when we find them, we annotate them in the letter, and we have a database in which we store all of these entries.
All right, so in other words, in a letter, he's referring to some work of literature. You've got to look it up, make sure you know what that is, and annotate it that way. He's referring to a place, mm-hmm. an event. That has to be, I would admit, this would be like a dream job. This has to be so much fun.
Oh, yes, many of our students who work on the project have described it as solving a puzzle,
yeah.
as solving a mystery. You get involved in the stories, you get caught up in them.
Especially if the references are somewhat obscure, right?
Yes. Sometimes we'll have someone as well known as Abraham Lincoln, of course. That's easy to annotate. But then we'll have someone who's a servant in the household, may have been an emancipated slave. So those records are more difficult to locate.
Really cool stuff. Now, before we continue in this conversation, I know Bethan Brighton was waiting to weigh in our previous half hour. She's on the line. Let me grab that phone call. Hi, Beth.
Hi. How are you, Evan?
Very good.
I just wanted to share, my sister-in-law spent more than 5 years in London and was the major mover of redoing Benjamin Franklin's house, which my husband and I got to tour, if you could walk through the steps, which were falling apart. In any case, she was a major mover and shaker of restoring everything about Benjamin Franklin when he lived in London, and is an incredible resource for anybody at the U of R who wants to talk to her about it. She's got more books and more things to share than anybody I know, and it's just Benjamin Franklin house that she spent hours and hours and years restoring. And anyway, I wanted to share that with the people in the community.
Painstaking work, but probably worth it, Beth?
Oh, she loved every minute of it. They live in South Carolina now, but they lived, well, more than 10 years in London. And that's where she spent her time and her life. You know, she's an architect by design. So, but it's just an incredible undertaking. And I'm proud of her and all the work she did. And I suspect she's got a whole lot of information she could share with whoever.
Well, Beth, thank you for that. And again, tomorrow, Carolyn Winter, who's been leading the Benjamin Franklin Project, is at the University of Rochester's Humanities Center as part of this new speaker series. And so we thought it was a logical extension of the conversation, talking about that project that Carolyn Winter is leading with Benjamin Franklin's letters to the Seward Project. And Camden Bird is a PhD candidate in American history. You know, Beth talks about restoring a house. We talk about tracking down letters and social networks, etc. What's the value to you in fleshing out these details? Some of them are sort of arcane, but when you really get down to the details of a person's life or a family life, as a student of American history, what's the value to you?
Well, I think it tells us a lot about what it was like to be people in this era. I think a lot of times we hold up historical characters as being not, you know, more than human. And I think when you read these letters, and especially with the rich collection of family letters that we have, it's really interesting to see how a 19th century family works and operates together, and sometimes very dysfunctional.
And sometimes with the tension. Blair, what's your job in this project?
So I'm the technical support. I work primarily with Camden on this, and he's doing some mapping of Auburn. So essentially, I taught Camden how to use mapping software, GIS software, and set up a spatial database form so we could enter some of this information into a database. So it's going to allow Camden down the road to keep adding places in and analyze the relationships between these places that they're entering in the database.
All right, Camden, help me see it then. What kind of mapping, I mean, we're familiar with basic mapping, but mm-hmm. the kind of mapping that Blair is talking about, how are you going to use it?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So, and Cerny was talking about the painstaking work that we go with annotating every person, every place, and that makes things really easy when it comes to mapping, where you can literally put someone on a map. And it's actually a lot like Carolyn Winner's project as far as creating a social network. In Auburn, we've done that with a lot of Francis Seward's contacts within Auburn. And because William Henry is actually gone for a lot of the time, she relies on a rich network of friends, of associates inside Auburn. And it's really interesting when you start to place people where they live, and you can see some tendencies about Auburn, New York. What does it tell us about Auburn, New York in 1830? What does it tell us about being a Seward in Auburn, New York?
Okay, so not just William Henry, this interesting family. What are we finding out about ideas, whether political, family ideas, the way they travel, the way they hit the street, the way they move? What are we learning here, Serenity?
So one of the things that's most interesting to me is how medicine was developing at this time. And Frances Seward became enamored with homeopathy, and she thought that it was one of the best ways in which to cure ills. And she herself suffered frequently from headaches. And in her letters, almost every letter starts off with an update of how she is, how her headaches are, and she asks about the health of others. And then she provides suggestions. And these suggestions are based off of what was to her a new medical science of the time called homeopathy. And so she's always offering these new ideas about medicine to her sister, to even to William Henry Seward, with a little bit of censure for him relying on the old medical theories and advising him to turn to homeopathy to cure his headaches and breaks and things like that. So that's one way in which ideas spread, especially it's outside of the political sphere. But as we mentioned before, the political sphere, especially for Frances, who is extremely well-read, that was where she loved to write to Henry about, is about talking about political things.
Abolition?
She was very adamant that William Henry Seward was being too conservative when it came to abolition, particularly when he was Secretary of State. There's this great line from an early 1860s letter where she writes to him and says she's so disappointed with one of his recent speeches, and that he was advocating for a moderate and for a gradual emancipation of the slaves. And she was saying, this is wrong. It is morally wrong to keep 6 million people enslaved. And so she was much more radical than her husband, although she wasn't a radical abolitionist by any means. She was just more passionate and had higher moral standards, perhaps, than William Henry himself did.
Did he respond in a way that, did he respond at all to the criticism typically? And if so, did he say, I'm being pragmatic here? You know, you may want a change overnight. We see the end goal. It's going to happen. There are political means to do it.
Well, he didn't say as much in letters. He was much more brief in his letters than the other members of the family. But we
just
have,
with her or in general?
In general. And members of his family would always write and say, please send us news, tell us more. But he was very busy. But we do have one letter where Frances recounts a conversation she had with Henry. And this was after she had pleaded with him to not be so conservative in his views on abolitionism. And she writes to her sister Lizette and recounts a conversation she had with Henry. And she says, "We had a good long talk, for the one of the longest talks we've had in so long. And he explained to me his positioning of why he felt that gradual emancipation was more practical." Now, she ends her this letter saying to Lizette, standing strong and true in abolitionism, and saying, "You know, I still believe that this is too conservative, and it needs to be done now." But she at least recounted this conversation, so we know that they did have these political conversations together.
How's the handwriting? How easy is it to sort through this stuff?
Well, there's a number of characters in the project. Camden, who's your least favorite handwriter? Who would you say?
William Henry Seward's
father.
And it,
his
you know,
own handwriting wasn't great, was it?
It was not great. Okay. Only, it depended how busy he was at the time, too.
Okay.
So, usually you would get very quick notes that, you know, what we would call scratches on, and expect readers to understand what's being said in a lot of ways. So, you know, a lot of students on the project would tell you they prefer certain family members over other members. And Francis is really great handwriting for most part.
Good handwriting.
Yes.
Easy to see.
Yeah.
Are there any annotations? Are there any roadblocks where you've hit and you said, "We cannot figure out what they're referring to"? Serenity, you're nodding. Yes.
Yes, there are many. And this has become sort of a source of counseling amongst members of the project, where we feel distraught if we can't track these people down. And ultimately, we have to remind ourselves that we'll try as hard as we can and spend as much time as we can to track people down. But some people are just simply we're unable to find them, unfortunately. But we do have a number of great resources online. We use Find a Grave, Ancestry.com. We use a lot of 19th century books and manuscripts, books from HathiTrust, which is an online database of 19th century books. So we have a lot of great resources that do help us find, I would say, about 90% of the people.
Do you have a favorite story and annotation that was hard to crack that stands out as something kind of quirky or very interesting to you, Serenity?
Well, I'll tell you a story that I'm working on right now. I'm transcribing a 27-page letter from a man touring Europe. It was an enclosure into a family letter. And this enclosure of his tales touring Europe, it came from one of their closest friends. So we decided to transcribe it. And he's writing about all of these places in Europe. And one of the things that's challenging is that the lines in Europe have since been redrawn since the 1830s. And so do we cite something as a town as being in Belgium, or do we cite it as being in the UK, or do we go through the history of World War I, World War II lines being redrawn on the map? So that's one case in which, you know, it's not challenging to find these places, but then how do we catalog them once we found them?
I'm listening to some listener feedback right now. Joel writes, "The Sewards are not the only famous people to live in Auburn. What about Tubman? Didn't Seward help her purchase a home?"
That's absolutely correct. William Henry Seward did help Harriet Tubman purchase a home not too far from where they lived in Auburn. And the Harriet Tubman House, like the Seward House Museum, is also a great place to visit. And Harriet Tubman, for listeners who might not know, was greatly involved in the Underground Railroad. And there is evidence that the Sewards themselves may have been involved in the Underground Railroad. Certainly Lizette Worden, who was Frances Seward's sister, was involved in the Underground Railroad. So there is a connection there between Harriet Tubman and William Henry Seward.
They had to be careful about that, right?
Very careful. And if you visit the Seward House Museum, they'll often have tours explaining a little bit about how careful you had to be in the Underground Railroad, because it could have jeopardized William Henry Seward's career. It could ostracize them from their community.
Now, Blair, when you're doing some of the mapping work and helping out, you know, Camden, for example, are you creating this for the purpose of the people who are sorting through these letters and creating these maps and connecting these dots, or are you thinking general public use down the line? Are we going to be able to use this?
No, it's definitely for public use, other scholars and researchers to use. We're just kind of at the early stages now, the data collection and kind of preliminary mapping. But the idea is to include as much mapping as we can into the web presence of the project, so that other scholars and researchers can use it and, you know, draw their own conclusions, form their own questions based on that data.
What do you see Camden being one of the end results of this project, not just for the scholars, but for the general public?
Well, I think we're going to launch the website this spring, and we're going to have a large collection of our preliminary letters up there. And I think, you know, scholars are obviously going to get a lot from this, but if you think about it, high school projects, I mean, this is something that you would have access to letters that we have at the River Campus Libraries, but, you know, through the help of student work, the project, Digital Humanities Center, it makes it accessible to people who can't travel to Rochester, New York all the time.
I am thinking about just the way history is taught and the way it was taught in the classes I had growing up. And, you know, the work that you're doing helps really create this texture to people. And you can't always sum it up in a couple of paragraphs or even a chapter or two in a history book. But I do think it will be interesting to see going forward the Benjamin Franklin Project, this project. Are there others like it, Serenity? I mean, I imagine anybody who we have access to their letters, we've got this chance to see the full person.
Yeah,
or as close to as possible.
Right. There are a number of digital humanities projects, which is what the Seward project and I believe also the Benjamin Franklin project will consider themselves a part of, just projects that have made this information that's sort of been kept away in an archive available to the wider public and to other scholars as well. Willa Cather Archive is one. Joseph Smith papers are another. So there's a number of collections out there, papers of the founding fathers that are online, that folks can access. History students from, second grade on up can access this, especially if they're transcribed. Students, high school students can access them. We are finding high school students aren't so good with cursive anymore, given that cursive isn't taught. But yeah, folks can, especially if they're transcribed, folks of the wider public can access them at any time.
All right, 20 seconds. And the Ben Franklin side, they're still finding letters here and there, sometimes in an attic, things like that. Do we think we've got most of the Seward papers and letters?
Well, to answer quickly, yes, but there are certainly more out there. We have a number of people who have generously donated the letters, and perhaps more people will come up even after hearing this broadcast.
Well, they'll know where to find you. You're going to be online in the spring, you said, Camden, and what's the website going to be? Do you know yet?
www.sewardproject.org, and that's in April of 2016.
Sewardproject.org.
That's correct.
It's under construction now. Thanks for your time with this, and good luck on the project. Let's talk in the spring. Very exciting work that you're doing, and really interesting stuff. That's Serenity Sutherland, Camden Bird, Blair Tinker, all working on the Seward Family Digital Archive. Fun hour. Really fun hour. Great stuff from them and from Carolyn Winter, who you can see tomorrow at the New Humanities Center at the University of Rochester. Have a great afternoon. Thanks to John Andrus, our engineer, and Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson, and this is Connections on member-supported public radio. I'm going to vote.